Pete Buttigieg goes on Fox News. Susan Brooks votes for the Equality Act. That plus a grim employer substance abuse survey and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending May 24th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Democratic presidential candidate and South Bend mayor Pete Buttigieg went on Fox News for a town hall. Some Democratic candidates, notably Elizabeth Warren, who called the network a, quote, hate-for-profit racket, refused to appear on the outlet this cycle, and the Democratic National Committee declined to hold any debates on Fox News. Buttigieg, in his Fox News town hall, acknowledged the ongoing debate, saying candidates have to, quote, find people where they are.
And I get where that's coming from, especially when you see what goes on with some of the opinion hosts on this network. I mean, when you got Tucker Carlson saying that immigrants make America dirty, when you've got Laura Ingraham comparing detention centers with children in cages to summer camps, then there is a reason why anybody has to swallow hard and think twice before participating in this media ecosystem.
Buttigieg's appearance also got attention from President Trump, who criticized Fox for doing it, perhaps in part because of an exchange about the president.
How would you handle the insults and the attacks and the tweets and all of that?
The tweets are... I don't care. It is the nature of grotesque things that you can't look away.
Is appearing on Fox News the right move for Pete Buttigieg? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican John Hammond, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. John Hammond, does Buttigieg's Fox News town hall help him or hurt him?
Well, I think any time you can get on any major broadcast news channel, it helps. It helps quite a bit. And to be on Fox News is a place where you have very devoted followers of that station, and almost every last one of those viewers will vote. So that's probably a good thing for him. I think one of the things that you've got here is a little bit of diminishing returns for him when he appears in a situation or before an audience that's really demographically, from a political standpoint, not his audience, in that he's got a great resume, high talent. He's a strongly talented person, but his record's a little weak. And frankly, from my perspective, I wish he could stay in South Bend and complete what is left to be done there, to be honest.
I bet you do.
Is this one of those, and then we're going to talk about another issue like that a little later on, is this one of those it's maybe good for the general and not so good for the primary?
I think it's good, period. I mean, you don't write off 38% of the population, and that's who listens to Fox, the 38% who support Donald Trump as president. You reach out to them. You know, when he was elected the last time as mayor of South Bend, he got 80% of the vote, and I dare say a percentage of those people were Trump supporters as well. And what he's showing is that he can communicate. He didn't back off any of his positions or anything else, but he shows himself as articulate and intelligent and reasoned and reasonable. And I think those are good characteristics to demonstrate. And you do it to any audience. I don't think it hurts you. I mean, Elizabeth Warren's comments notwithstanding. I mean, we all have our issues with Fox News, but her comments notwithstanding, I don't think it hurts him to demonstrate that he can stand up on his values in front of any audience and hold his own.
Although it didn't seem like the audience was maybe the Fox News audience that one would expect either.
No, it was a pretty friendly audience for him, but I still think it was a great move. I mean, I would hope that all candidates would want to speak to all the voters and not just a certain segment. Just like I hope that all voters would want to listen to all candidates. And that's not actually how it works a lot, but, you know, in the utopian society. And philosophic differences aside on where his positions are and they might stand, I haven't seen any negative criticism. I mean, he was focused and you know, very clear and concise, and I think
funny at times.
He hit it, yeah.
Does he actually end up gaining points, if only because there is the debate within the party about should we or should we not go on Fox News. And so the fact that he went on is going to garner more attention simply because he's on the channel.
Well, it does garner more attention. And also there's something to be said for the notion of being battle tested. If, in fact, he were to get the nomination and he had steered clear of Fox throughout the primary process, you can't steer clear of Fox in that audience forever. So one would assume that to have experience with that audience, fielding those questions, and sort of having gone into battle and survived, I think that bodes well. And I would echo what Nikki suggests, that, you know, the title is President of the United States, not President of the Democratic Party or President of the Republican Party. And I know that may seem kind of quaint now in this era, but at some point you would like to think that we can have a president who is able to look at their fellow Americans with some sense of interest and compassion, and
unlike what we currently have.
I guess you can infer that I'm saying that.
Well, but Mayor Pete, I think, is having he'll have a tough time breaking up through the ranks. I mean, Biden, Sanders, those folks are running pretty strong. Mayor Pete said about 6%. It seems like he almost but he's kind of come down. Well, we're not. I don't think we're going to see that happen. He's a very talented person.
Is it because there's too many candidates?
Well, we don't know that yet. Ultimately, we had 17 and 16 on the Republican ticket. So all this will shake itself and sort itself out. Mm-hmm. I think going back to South Bend, being the mayor, and getting a little better record there would be helpful.
Well, wait a minute. We nominated a reality show person with no experience the last time from your ticket.
He's the president of the United States.
He
at the
may
moment.
Be the president now, but you certainly was unqualified when you nominated.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: will Democratic presidential candidates' appearances on Fox News, like Pete Buttigieg's, help or hurt their campaigns? A, it'll help, or B, it'll hurt. Last week's question: will continued tariffs have negative consequences for President Trump at the ballot box in Indiana? 66% of you say it will, and 34% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Indiana Congresswoman Susan Brooks was one of only 8 Republicans out of 197 in the House to vote for the Equality Act. The Equality Act would amend the Federal Civil Rights Act to ban discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. The bill, supported by Democrats and progressives, drew the ire of Republicans. Indiana Congressman Jim Banks called it, quote, perhaps the most radical proposal ever put forth in the House, and says it undermines religious liberty. 5th District Representative Susan Brooks was among a small number of GOP members to vote for the measure. She says the country can't turn a blind eye towards the discrimination faced by the LGBTQ community. But the bill has also come under fire because of its potential implications on abortion. Conservatives argue the measure's language would undo the so-called conscience protections of medical professionals who refuse to participate in abortion care. Brooks acknowledged those concerns and says she'll seek clarifying language if the bill advances. And Delaney, what do you make of this vote from Susan Brooks?
What did they say about a broken watch being right twice a day? This is the second time she voted for in favor of the Violence Against Women Act as well, and I think has been pretty consistent on some of the violence regarding gender issues. And I think she deserves a lot of credit for breaking with her caucus on this. I mean, we've seen what's happened in other states where transgender people have been beaten and killed, in fact, because they're transgender. I mean, the fact that we would be upset about discrimination on those categories, whether it's sexual identity or gender identity, the fact that we would not want to give additional protection to those people, which we didn't do in Indiana in the last legislative session, is appalling to me. I think her vote is exactly right, and shame on the rest of the Republicans for not joining with her.
There, we've already talked on the show, and there's been talk out there that Democrats are looking at suburban districts across the country as targets in 2020, and Susan Brooks is on at least an early list of those targets. Is this a nod towards perhaps a more robust challenge from a Democrat in next year?
Well, I think, first of all, I think Susan Brooks is in good shape in her district, period. And I do applaud her for the vote here on this particular measure. And she's involved at the leadership level within the Republican House conference, if you will, to recruit quality female candidates throughout the country. So She's got plenty of, I think, support in her own district. It allows her to get out and across the country to bring in strong new Republican women potentially to run for Congress in some seats that we gave up, whether it's in California or Pennsylvania and some of these suburban areas, which I think we can get back, truly do.
At the same time that there's talk of a more robust Democratic challenge against Susan Brooks, there's also whispers of a Republican challenge in the primary, and it would be not from her left but from her right. Does a vote like this make that more likely?
Well, it certainly would make a more likely Democratic victory in November, aside from the primary, because that's not a monolithic district. To your point, the suburban districts here and around the country tend to be not that much, you know, Republican, and Donald Trump, come hell or high water, I'm there no matter what. It's a little more nuanced. I think she appreciates that. And I'm not saying she's doing it solely for political reasons.
No.
She has, as John suggests, there are other reasons that suggest that this has been a path she has been on for some time. But if she were challenged, and that seems to be the modus operandi these days, if she were challenged, I think it would effectively mean that seat will go. Presuming there's
if she loses the primary challenge.
If she lost the primary challenge, and then there were a very legitimate, credible Democratic candidate, given that makeup of that district.
You can be certain there'll be a legitimate, well-funded,
Democratic candidate. I think that would bode well then for the Democratic candidate, if there is such a person in the race.
This vote is this bill and this vote has attracted a lot of attention. Is it the kind of thing that we will be talking about in regards to Susan Brooks a year from now? Ahead of the primary.
Yeah, I think this vote will definitely be a factor in either way, either in a primary if someone attacks her, or in the fall where she can point to it towards some of the demographics that have shifted in her district to say, you know, I'm open, I'm not lockstep, I'm, you know, I'm open to other options.
Except that two votes do not a summer make. In this case, and she's had two good votes where she's broken with the Trump administration and the majority of the Republicans.
Yeah, I think
and
she votes with the Trump administration
98% of the time.
But sometimes that 2% can make a difference with some voters.
And Ann's tried very hard over a couple of cycles to try to make the point so that there's a replacement for Susan Brooks. But again, she continues to win pretty handily. And I think she's matched up with that district pretty well. Two things. One thing I'd like to say about you, we've got Congresswoman Brooks, and we've got our congressman from Fort Wayne,
Jim Banks,
who
did not agree on this one.
Did not agree, so I'm going to raise that. But you know, I think it's great and very interesting that at least within our party, anyway, we've got people who can be on different sides. They can vote their convictions. And they did in this case. I applaud both of them for it.
Don't tell Representative Amash that in
Michigan. 7 versus 190-some-odd is not exactly the diversity one would expect in a party that's open-ended.
Moving on, a large majority of Indiana employers in a new survey this week say substance misuse is a problem in the community, but only a few, just 13%, think it's an issue in their own company. The Indiana Chamber of Commerce and Wellness Council survey of 500 Hoosier employers paints a grim picture. Less than half of employers have adequate health benefits for employees struggling with substance misuse. Only about a third think their organization can support people in recovery. And Hoosier employees are just as likely to be fired after a failed drug test than given a second chance. State leaders say there must be better education and awareness around substance misuse issues. Part of that comes from new employer guidelines released by the state, guidance and best practices for how to respond to employee substance use issues. Nikki Kelly, as we continue to have the opioid crisis in this state and in this country, how problematic are some of these survey numbers?
I was a little surprised. I mean, I would think the very basics of, you know, identifying a problem and referring them to someone who can help seems, you know, baseline, and I can't believe that many companies don't even have that. But then again, you know, we're seeing a major transition here. It used to be just you're doing drugs, you're out, you know. Now we've got such a worker shortage that companies can't afford to just kick everyone out the door. They've got to provide some sort of, you know, help for them to try to keep the employees they need.
Yeah, how problematic do you find this?
I think Nikki's assessment is right on target in terms of the evolution of this issue. We're not where we were as a society or as a state a decade ago when you could demand squeaky clean, you know, healthful living in all regards and expect that you would have 100% compliance. It's just the numbers aren't there anymore. When you have virtual full employment nationwide and you have such a pervasive problem with the use or misuse of illegal substances or substances that are illegal but are improperly used, the numbers just don't work. And either you're going to have to rely even more heavily on automation and on technology and robotics, where you don't have to give drug tests, or find a way to work with these employees to look at them more holistically and say, how can, I mean, we've seen that in terms of their skill development. That's what workforce development's all about. How about also embracing them in terms of their personal challenges or their health challenges?
The opioid crisis is certainly not new, and it's not new in Indiana, and we've seen a lot of focus on it from the government and from the Chamber of Commerce and businesses for half a decade now. So why is it, though, that some of these numbers seem to be lagging behind that public awareness that's been trying to be pushed out there?
I don't know, and maybe someone on the panel does know. I do think, you know, multiple strategies have been deployed, employed. They are continuing to be deepened. I know the Holcomb administration made this one of the five pillars, and they spent a lot of time and resources across all agencies, multiple functions, working with communities, trying to make this scourge go away and bring the public awareness to the point where we can curb it and don't have the misuse or abuse, however you want to state it, but both things that may be occurring. And it's going to lag a little while yet until we can see that this awareness has taken hold.
76% of the employers in the survey say, yes, it's a problem. Only 13% say it's a problem in my office, in my
company.
I was just, is that the
we have
I
a
hate
lot
Congress,
of,
but I like my congressperson?
I think we have a lot of employers who may identify with ostriches. I think their heads are buried in the sand. They're not looking carefully enough.
I'll give you that one.
If they did, they would find that the problem is more pervasive than they're giving it credit for.
And, so, and that was one of the things the leadership talked about at this event this week, which is there is data you can look at in your own company with your own healthcare plans, absenteeism, you know, injuries on the job, things like that. There's stuff you can look at to say, oh, maybe it is a problem, even if you don't see it in that sense.
Right.
So we'll see if more companies start listening. Well, Attorney General Curtis Hill won't get a hearing in a disciplinary case surrounding sexual misconduct allegations against him until late October. Curtis Hill is accused of unwanted groping by four women, including a state lawmaker, at a party last year. Attorneys for Hill and the state's disciplinary commission met with hearing officer Myra Selby this week to lay out a schedule for the next few months. And while the dates for the expected week-long hearing into the allegations aren't finalized, both sides agreed to one of the last 2 weeks of October. The witness lists could be as many as 25 people long. The attorneys say they'll work from a list of 56 witnesses interviewed by the Indiana Inspector General. The disciplinary commission complaint against Hill could result in a suspension of his law license, which puts in jeopardy his ability to continue serving as attorney general.
We've had to wait.
John Schwanes, does having this hang over Curtis Hill's head for several more months impact him and his job?
I think to a certain extent it does. If in fact he says he's, and he does say he's innocent, that this is being railroaded, well, then you want to, if you're in his shoes, you want to get this done as quickly as possible, it seems to me, because in the interim, every story, every time he unveils a new policy or something that he sees as sort of wide-reaching for the office, you know, last week we talked about some of the salary increases that he had given top staffers. Now every story, or just about every story, that is about some policy pronouncement that he has put
also
forth.
Also has a line
also
in it
has
about.
That inevitable line in there that says, oh, and by the way, is what he's putting forth his proposal shaped in any way by these allegations, or even if it's just a footnote that this is upcoming, keep it on your calendar, save the date.
Yeah.
Either way, it's not good for him because it just continues the discussion.
And Nikki, you know, the hearing will be one of the last 2 weeks of October. But the actual resolution here is still even further than that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I assume they'll take some time to draft recommendations for the Supreme Court to consider what they find appropriate discipline, if any. Although, I got to be honest, I mean, it hasn't really impacted his job so far. I thought in the beginning of all this that it would, but he seems to be skating right along, and he's getting out there more, doing live interviews, meeting with reporters, so... You know, I think part of his goal, at least, is to at least be able to say to his detractors, you're not going to say I didn't do my job during all this.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't really seen it impact him that much, except for the fact that maybe last year we just didn't see him very much out in public. But other than that, the office is still running.
He's racing right towards the nomination for a second term on the Republican side.
So does this being dragged out impact that at all?
I mean, John could speak to that. I hope it doesn't impact that more. I hope he is the nominee for the Republicans because I think he is vulnerable. I think people think his conduct was very reprehensible. And the fact that he's the leading judicial officer of the state of Indiana, court judges notwithstanding, he is an embarrassment to the state. It really is. And the fact that he's still in office when there were so many witnesses to conduct that was completely unacceptable, people just shake their heads and say, how can that happen?
Every step forward is a step closer to that convention next summer. Is that a problem for him?
Well, of course. Each day that goes by where you can't really focus in campaign in that regard or maybe distracted from your official duties, it becomes an issue. But I think both sides of this controversy will have their day in court in front of
a disciplinary version
of a tribunal. And no matter what path they choose and what decision they make, I hope it's with some finality one way or the other. It just makes it a difficult thing for Curtis Hill as he tries to kind of sort out his future.
But if the discipline is a suspension of the license, I think that's going to raise all kinds of other questions which could be litigated for months beyond that.
I would not intrude into the proceeding by making a comment about it one way or the other on my end, but I do think we ought to cross that bridge when we get to
that. That day in court, I think you're right, needs to take place in the public eye under the scrutiny of the spotlight because there was a push by the Curtis Hill camp to have even this pre-conference hearing,
technical in nature,
take place behind closed doors, and I think that sends a wrong message. I think for this to really have some resolution, whether it's in his favor or not, it needs to be done.
Also, it makes it easier to compare which story he's using this particular time if you get all five of them out there at the same time.
All right. Well, Vice President Mike Pence returned to Indiana this week to deliver the commencement address at Taylor University's graduation. Most of the audience at Taylor, a Christian university in Northeast Indiana, greeted the vice president with a standing ovation, though a few dozen students and faculty walked out in protest ahead of Pence's remarks. Pence touted the American economy, telling the graduates that they're leaving school at a great time. He also urged them to stand up for their faith at a time when he argues Christian beliefs are under attack, and he encouraged the Taylor grads to, quote, take a servant's attitude in whatever they do.
John Hammond, do you think small protests like what we saw from some Taylor faculty and students accomplish much?
Well, first of all, I mean, everyone has a right to protest and free speech in this country, and I think Mike Pence recognizes that more than anyone. You guys remember that when he was at Broadway at the production of Hamilton, he had to withstand all that. He said some pretty gracious things afterwards when he was not treated very well. In this case, this is a pretty small protest. Probably gets more media attention than the actual strength of the protest. But, do they accomplish much? I think it allows somebody to express their opinion and feelings. And look, it is a free country, and they're certainly welcome to do that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with John on that. You know, you're in an institution that is professing to support Christian values, and those people felt very strongly that his position in favor of discrimination against gays and transgender people and all doesn't reflect the Christianity that they embrace, and they expressed it, and that's within their rights as Americans. And there's no problem with that.
Is that really what it is? This worked exactly the way it's supposed to?
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure Vice President Pence would say the same thing. After all, he's walked out himself once before on a football game when
people on camera.
Took a knee.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. All right, yeah. Finally, it is one of the greatest weekends in Indiana as Sunday, hopefully with the rain, features the 103rd running of the greatest spectacle in racing, the Indianapolis 500. So I'll start with you, Anne Delaney. Who will win?
I'm going with the Hoosier Ed Carpenter. It's his year.
John?
The weatherman loses, but the winner is Simon Pagenaud.
Pole position.
Let's go off the board with Tony Kanaan.
Tony Kanaan.
Okay, well, Anne stole my Ed Carpenter, so I'm going to do a backup of Hinchcliffe.
Yeah, we should really I should really have you each email me your picks right
advance.
When I send out the script. And that way, whoever gets in first. Whoever gets in first.
Well, I spoke first.
You always
true.
Get to.
Yeah. All right. I employed a little bit of data mining into my pick. So. No one's won from the pole position for a decade, since 2009, so I didn't want to go with Pagenaud.
And the second most wins at the 500 have come from the third position, not the second. It's close. So I'm going with Spencer Pigot in the third position.
And what are you prepared to offer if you don't win?
Oh, absolutely.
You left
nothing.
Out one.
I'm not knowledgeable enough about racing to wager anything.
A free coffee cup?
You left out the research tidbit you should know, which is I've never, ever on this show picked one
right
correctly.
Yeah.
So,
Well, that's why I didn't go with Tony.
Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican John Hammond, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.